Whether you are halashing for halas or wanting to bri or fine dine, this is Essen Fressen with Adrian Bargati. It's all about the food.
Welcome to the Essen Fressen show. I'm your host, Adrian Bargati. Today we're going to look at some seasonal recipes, some food trends, and some nutritional insights. And hopefully that will give you some ideas of meals to make and things that you want to see on your plates or that you want to see your kids eating. So it's important to always keep up and see what's around. I know that when I was a junior nurse, things started off, we had a whole different way of eating. Our food plates looked different, and certain foods that we today know are safe and really good to eat was kind of a no-no. Things like you should have margarine, you've got to stop having butter. Well, they've since discovered that to a certain extent, it makes no difference if you're having margarine or butter, they're both fat. But one is a natural fat and one is a synthetic fat. And people are moving away from processed foods, which is a good thing. Now, the weather's turned a little colder, so we're going to have a look at a couple of autumn recipes. And once again, I think I've done it before a while ago, is to look at eggplant, which I think is the most underrated vegetable or fruit, should I say, around. Eggplants, aubergines, brinjals, whatever you want to call them, they're just amazing. I like them. Let's put it this way, personal choice. So that's the things we're going to talk about. In the food trends, we're kind of talking about something that so far hasn't affected us here in South Africa, but maybe it's a topic of conversation around the country, around the world, because I know I've been asked about it in the past, and that is factory grown meat. So that's an important one that's going to start changing. As things change, we need to find out more about it. And then something I'd never heard of, and I saw it on a show a while ago, called 3D food printing, which is also quite an interesting topic to look at. So those are what we're going to cover. And with, obviously, as always, there's some recipes involved. And just enjoy. So grab your aprons. Let's dive right in to today's show. The first thing is the current food trend for cultured meat, it's called. Cultured meat is meat that has been grown in a laboratory. So imagine doing a juicy burger without the environmental impact of a traditional farm. You know, no cows polluting or eating all the grass or whatever. The reason for most people becoming vegetarian, instead of health options, they've become vegetarian out of humanitarian options. Now, many, many, many years ago, obviously, the Rambam actually wrote about how to look after your animals. And it's part of Jewish culture that you need to farm in a way that doesn't stress out the animals. And that has kind of changed with mass farming. And there is a growing trend in the Jewish community because of that towards not eating meat, not for health reasons or anything, but the fact that we no longer have this organic type of farming, that the cows or the chicken or whatever you're eating is mass produced. They live in quite stressful environments and in tight environments. There's overgrazing, hormone injections, all those kind of things. And some people see it as a type of cruelty to the animals that we are eating, and therefore they've moved away from eating meat and have moved on to things. They won't eat farmed fish. They won't eat battery chickens. Everything needs to be free range and organic. Now, being kosher, that can only be done in like very large places where there is a big enough Jewish community to warrant that kind of money on animals and livestock. So we're not going to ever see that here in our country in South Africa. Yes, there is free range and organic available to the non-kosher community. And most people say they're healthier. I have found a farmer and, well, we found a farmer who does, he makes his own feed. And for the most part, the chickens are roaming. They're not free range as such, but they are roaming around. They're not stuck in battery warehouses. So it does make it a little bit expensive, but the chickens are quite large because they're fed with homemade food, and that works really, really well. So let's have a look at cultured meat and see how that works out. Okay. Imagine enjoying a juicy burger without the environmental impact of traditional farming. Now, cultured meat is called lab-grown meat. Its innovative approach involves cultivating animal cells in vitro to produce meat without raising and slaughtering animals. So, what this is in vitro means it's the cells inside, like in the cow. I don't know how to describe it. Let's have a look. Sorry, I'm going to have to Google this. Unfortunately, I do have a bit of memory loss. So, in vitro is may it's a test tube, basically. I don't know why I didn't know that. It's a test tube. So they're creating the cells because if you take stem cells have got no identity, and they can make it into anything. We're using it in medicine a lot. You create stem cells. The stem cells are then grown into tissue for burns. They can, in the future, and I think they're pretty far along with this, grow them into organs and things for transplants that you would have your own. So they grew a kidney. They would be able to then transplant, take that kidney that they grew and put it into the patient. So it's their own kidney, just a new one. I think at the moment they've just been able to do things like ears and skin, like simple stuff, relatively in medical terms. Now, this lab-grown meat is not that new. It's been the last 25 years that they've been making and experimenting, and it's grown. That like in 2020, that's when they started in 2000, and in 2013, the first lab-grown burger was unveiled. Sorry. And by 2020, Singapore approved the commercial sale of cultured chickens. So, and the question of which came first, the chicken or the egg, apparently it's the chicken. Now, this is a great potential to reduce the greenhouse effect, the gas emissions, to conserve water, and as I said before, to address animal welfare concerns like over farming. While not yet widely available, obviously, there are only a few places. I think you can get it in America. And if I'm not mistaken, it is available in Israel. And that is a topic we're going to cover about this as well. The research and investment, they're paving the way for cultured meat to become a staple in our diets. So some people are going to be able to leave veganism and go back to eating meat because there were no animals involved in this thing. In fact, there is a question of whether there is any meat. Now, while the concept of lab-grown or factory-grown meat is still emerging, the ruling from Jewish authorities about its kosher status up for debate. There are some concerns that would obviously need to be addressed before it can be considered kosher. Majority, from what I understand, is it's not kosher. It's as simple as that. So let's find out what they had to say. Now, unfortunately, finding proper information was a little bit more complicated than it normally is, and very limited. So I did unfortunately have to use Wikipedia for some of it, but I did use Chabad for others, and there are a few other websites. Now, here's a breakdown of why they may not be considered kosher in halachic requirements. Now, first of all, it must be coming from a specific animal, obviously, the kosher requirement, which means split hooves. The birds can't be are listed. You can't have birds of prey. And it's got to have been slaughtered by Jewish law and by a shochet, so to remove the blood. Now, the challenges with cultured meat is the source of the cells. Now, the cells used to be to grow the meat would need to come from a kosher animal in the first place. And the process of obtaining and culturing those cells could raise concerns about the purity of the meat. Where did they get it from? Did it cause the animal pain? Have they mixed those cells with other animal cells to make them grow better or taste better or whatever it is that they're going to do? Slaughter and removal of the blood. Obviously, the kosher current slaughter process is very specific, and that doesn't apply to cultured meat. So It's grown from cells rather than slaughtered. So what do we do about the blood that will come out of the meat that you grow in a cell, in from a cell? Is it blood? Is it considered blood? Do we need to kosher it the same way we would in the old days when you slaughter went out into your farm and slaughtered your chicken or slaughtered your cow and then had to kosher all the meat? Also, the utensils and equipment used for the cultivation process need to be kosher and designated only with those meat, and that could be a challenge. Now, the issue is this. This is all in a lab. There's no animal involvement after the first cell born taken. What are they going to do following? Like, is it every time they want to grow? What is the cost going to be? Is it going to be more? Is it less? Yes, the environmental impact is probably a lot less. But what about the impact to our wallets? Is that going to be less? Not so sure. Now, there is actually no current ruling about this. Like I said, as technology is still developing, there's no official ruling from any specific rabbinical authority on whether it's considered kosher or not. However, currently, the thought process is it is not considered kosher. So even if you are somewhere and, like in Israel, they are not saying that you can have this meat yet. And halal also is having questions. So whether you're kosher or halal, the concept of lab-grown meat also raises the question in the dietary, in halal dietary law, because of the specific requirements for slaughter and blood removal. So quite an interesting topic. I'd love to hear your views on that. You can always write to Chai FM and just let us know how you feel about these things. I'm Adrian Bugatti, and you're listening to the Essen Fressen Show.
Whether you are challishing for challahs or wanting to braai or fine dine, this is Essen Fressen with Adrian Bugatti. It's all about the food.
We're talking about food trends and things that are coming, like food for the future, I would call it. And we've spoken now about lab-grown meat, still up in the air about whether it's kosher or not, or halal or not, because of the way it is grown. Now there's a new one, which I had never ever heard about. Didn't know it was a real thing. I've heard of 3D printing. In fact, I have two beautiful little candle holders that a friend made me from her 3D printer. But now they're doing 3D food printing, and that's a little confusing to me. I think that is quite a big thing. And technology continues to revolutionize kitchens, and 3D food printing is front and center of that currently. It's a technology that is going to allow us to create intricate, food designs by layering ingredients very precisely. So instead of the chef having this absolutely amazing skill at plating and seeing the creations like that Heston Blumenthal does with these beautiful sciences, where he creates little bubbles and spheres and cracks shells, or you're looking at Chef Amri, who does the most beautiful chocolate creations, you're now going to be able to 3D print those things. So why not food? We've been able to do 3D printing for toys, for guns, unfortunately, for organs are being 3D printed as well. The ones that need specific things on surgeries and that. And those are important things to look at. So it's a question of whether you can use them or not. It's a novelty currently, but 3D food printing offers a practical application. And this is customized meals for individuals with dietary restrictions. So here's where I have a struggle with this. We have a patient, say, and I'm looking at it from a nursing perspective, not as a parent and not as a foodie as such. We have a patient who is needing a high protein diet to recover from a burn wound. So when they're in hospital, they get put up, there's a drip called albumin. Albumin is usually the egg white, but this is a synthetic one. Now they're saying that they can customize a meal that is going to fit this? Now, I don't understand how the nutritional value is going to come out of this. For me, it would be more of what it looks like, a showpiece, than a taste value. How are you 3D printing the taste? How are you 3D printing the nutritional value in it? All of those things, it's going to look beautiful, but is it going to smell like what it's supposed to? Is it going to look, taste like it looks? I mean, a beautiful pink piece of cured salmon, it's gorgeous. So, yes, you're going to get that, but are you going to be able to cut it into that beautiful flake, that beautiful soft texture? How does this work? So, I'm very, very confused about this, and it'd be interesting to watch it as it moves along, as it progresses. Now, like I said, I got this from Wikipedia, and there is a question on whether we'd be allowed to do the 3D printing. A bigger question, what broccoli would you use? It's a printed food. It isn't grown. It hasn't come from the ground. It hasn't come from the tree. It hasn't come from anywhere. It's come from a machine. So already that to me is a bit of a confusion. So I'm going to leave you with those thoughts about whether you can do the 3D printing. And like I said, a lot of people have asked like halakhic questions on what the rabbis say about this and whether it is allowed. So here's what, so I had a look and it says Jewish religious beliefs regarding cultured meat and 3D food printing revolve around kashrut dietary laws. Since these technologies are relatively new, rabbinic authorities have been debating their status. And here is a bit of a breakdown on how they might be viewed. Okay, like really, cultured meat, not considered actual meat if the cells undergo a significant transformation. Whereas others believe that because it originates from an animal, it should still be considered meat. So yes, everyone seems to agree that it must come from a kosher meat animal. And some argue that the cells are taken in a way that don't involve slaughtering. They may not require the shechita. I'm not so sure about that though. And because it's, oh, that was another one. Because it's not actually meat, whether it's 3D printed or lab grown, can you have meat and milk together? I think that's going to be a big question. Does this retain its meat consideration? As for the 3D printed meat, the biggest factor on that is where are the ingredients from? So, if the 3D printed food is from a kosher ingredient, so let's say the ink is made from blueberries, right? It's kosher. But what happens is if the ink is made from the cochineal beetle because you want something red, now that's not allowed. It's not kosher. So, those are the kind of things that have to be thought about. The other thing is Shabbos. If you're printing process that involves cooking, which hasn't made sense to me, and I've tried to look up more of that, it didn't come up. Then what do we do? How do we do it on Shabbos? So they would say you would have to assemble all the food ingredients before Shabbos and then do it. So that's another question. I feel sorry for these rabbis. And then obviously, once again, remember I said, what bracha are we going to say? Because do we even need a bracha? Because if it doesn't resemble the original thing and it's printed, it wasn't grown. Do we still say the bracha? What do we do? Love to hear your thoughts on those. So that's why we're having a thing. Good discussion. So both technologies, whether you're doing 3D printing or lab-grown meat, are going to need a lot more insight. Yes, maybe they've started this 25 years ago, but we're still looking into it. I'm Adrian Bugatti, and this is the Essen Fresen Show.
Whether you are halashing for halas or wanting to braai or fine dine, this is Essen Fresen with Adrian Bugatti. It's all about the food.
Temperatures are dropping. Pesach is on its way. Means it's getting cold at night, and it's time to think of Pesach stuff. So I've got a little recipe to share with you. It's perfect for autumn and it'll work well for Pesach as well. And the first one is butternut soup. Love roasted butternut soup. It's warm, it's filling, and it can be a meal just on its own. This serves four people. So you get one medium butternut, peeled and cubed, 2 tablespoons of olive oil, one onion chopped, 2 cloves of garlic minced, 4 cups of vegetable stock, 1 teaspoon of ground nutmeg, salt and pepper to taste, and optional, either a swirl of cream if you're doing it dairy or a swirl of orli if you're doing it meat, and some toasted pumpkin seeds for garnish. Now, the seeds obviously we can't use if you're doing this oven pacer. First thing to do is to preheat your oven quite warm, so 200 degrees, and then you're going to toss the butternut in olive oil and you're going to season it with salt and pepper, spread it on a roasting tray, and put it into the oven for about 25 to 30 minutes until it's tender and it's slightly caramelized. When it's caramelized, you'll see it'll have like a, it almost looks like you sprinkled sugar over the top. In a large pot, you're going to saute the onion in olive oil, some more olive oil, until they're like shiny or translucent. And then add the minced garlic and cook for another minute. You should start smelling the aromas of garlic. Taking your roasted garlic, gem squash, you go, sorry, not gem squash, butternut, you're going to put it into the pot. You're going to pour over the stock and you're going to bring it to a simmer. And then you're going to let it cook for about 10 minutes so that all the flavors of the onion and garlic can be, and the vegetable stock can come into the butternut pieces. Using a stick blender, which is a lot easier, you're going to puree the soup until smooth. Obviously, if you're not, don't have a stick blender, please be very careful putting it into an ordinary blender with enough liquid to help it mix and then put it back in the pot. Adjust your seasoning by stirring in your ground nutmeg and salt and pepper according to taste. And then you can serve with your cream or your toasted seeds or your Oli Whip, whichever you're going to do. Now, this recipe I found, and people don't use the herb sage often enough. We hear it only when you're talking about cleansing the air of impurities and things. People go and sage their homes and just refreshes it and it just gets things moving. But it goes really well with chicken. So I found a recipe for apple and sage. They did it, it was stuffed pork. I'm doing stuffed chicken breasts. Apple and sage stuffed chicken. It combines the sweetness of the apples with the earthiness of sage, and it's amazing. Just be careful with chicken breast, it cooks very quickly. So I have made adjustments, but depending on, I'm working on a gas stove. If you're working on an electric stove, the timing may be a little different. So the first thing is about 500 grams of chicken breast. That's around, I'd say, I would take one to a half to one chicken breast per person. If it's a big eater, then the full breast. If it's a smaller eater, then half a breast should be good enough because the filling is going to fill you up along with the sides that you're going to use. So you take one apple, peel, core, and dice. Now, it doesn't matter which apples you use. I prefer for this recipe, I would use a Golden Delicious. But if you would like something a little bit more tart, then a Granny Smith is great. And if you'd like something with a little more sweetness, then I would use a red apple. One small onion, finely chopped, 2 cloves of garlic minced, 1 tablespoon of fresh sage chopped. Now, if you can't get fresh sage, you can buy the dried sage. And remember, it's a tablespoon is 15 mils, so you would use 5 mils of sage instead of dried sage. 1 tablespoon of olive oil. You don't have to use olive oil. Any recipe that calls for olive oil, if you don't have it, use a flavorless oil. The reason they use olive oil, and you must be careful with the olive oil that you're buying. Olive oil has a peppery taste to it. So you need to decide. If you're using a vegetable oil of some sort, an avocado oil or any of those, they have no flavoring. So you will need to adjust your seasoning quite a lot more. Then you're going to preheat your oven to 190. Oh, sorry, I left out some stuff. Salt and pepper. And then we use a little bit of white wine for deglazing. Now, the wine burns off, the alcohol will burn off during the deglazing process. The only time that your alcohol really stays in your food is if you're doing a dessert that didn't require cooking. So if you're making like a kirsch cake or something that you've got the liqueur in, that liqueur is going to stay. The heat will evaporate the alcohol in the wine and leave the fruity flavor. So in a pot, you're going to heat your olive oil. Now I use a pot. You can use, if you've got a very deep-sided frying pan that is oven proof, you could use that. I tend to use pots, just easier for me. Heat olive oil over a medium heat, and you can saute the onions again till they're glossy and translucent. Then you add your garlic, your diced apple, and your sage, and you cook it until the apple softens. Season with salt and pepper and let the mixture cool a little bit. So when you're putting it into the chicken, you need to be able to handle it. You're going to butterfly your chicken breast by slicing it lengthwise without cutting it all the way through. So you want to take that one chicken breast so that you can open it and it's double in size. Then you're going to put like cling film over the top of your chicken breasts. And you can use, if you've got a meat tenderizer, use that. Otherwise, you can use something heavy that you can smash the meat with to just like thin it out. You want it quite thin because you want it to cook quickly and all the way through. So, and it must be even. So, you know that when you butterfly your chicken breast, it's going to have some thick parts and some thin parts. So, start working on the thicker parts first, and you might not have to beat the whole chicken. You want it all one, like one thickness. I'd say about 0.5 to 1 centimeter thick would be good. If you would like not want to do the butterflying, if you're uncertain of your skill, then just cover that chicken breast with the cling film and bash it until it's all even, and you'll see it'll double in size. It does get quite big, so it's good enough. You're going to spread the apple and sage mixture over each chicken piece. So remember to divide it up into how many chicken pieces you're having, and then roll it up to secure it with some kitchen string or something that can go in the oven and won't burn or won't melt. So be careful what you choose to close it. Now, I've said 1.5 to 1 chicken breast per person, but when you're beating it up, you need to judge for yourself if it's going to be too little or too much, and if what else you're serving with, as I said earlier. Heat a bit of olive oil in an oven-proof, well, skillet, so a deep-sided frying pan, but it must be one that can go in the oven. So nothing with a wooden handle or a plastic handle. And you're just going to brown the meat all over. So it's very, very quick. Take it out. You can, if it's sticking to the pan, you can pour in that splash of wine and just get all the stickiness off the bottom. You're going to put the chicken into the oven for about 15 to 20 minutes. You want the temperature to get to about 74 degrees Celsius. So that is your chicken. And then obviously you let it rest a little bit before you can slice it up and serve it. And when you're slicing it, it'll be beautiful round, so it looks really good on a plate. And last but not least, eggplant. Like I said, one of the most undervalued fruits on the planet. Yes, it is a fruit. It is part of the nightshade, so it falls in the category of tomatoes, which are also fruits, but neither one goes well with a fruit salad. So eggplants are also known aubergines or brinjals, and they are so versatile, and they add like a lot of depth, and they're great for vegetarians who would like that little bit of fiber and the meat feel, should I say, because they can be. Now, a lot of people don't like them because they are quite bitter, and there's differing opinions of whether you salt your sliced brinjal or whether you just leave it. Now, the benefits are rich in antioxidants. Eggplants contain anthocyanins. Doesn't matter how many times I practice that. And something called nasunin, which protects cells from damage caused by free radicals. So it's considered something that can help reduce the risk of cancer. I'm not sure that anybody's proven it, but that's what they feel it can do. It is also high in fiber, so it promotes digestive health and helps maintain steady blood levels. Now, the thing with this is, you have to understand, this is a great one as for people who have celiac or are gluten intolerant, and you can't have whole wheat breads or any whole wheat or high fiber cereals and things like this. You'd be able to get your fiber from your eggplant. So bake them, fry them, make them, use them as a lasagna sheet instead. They are very, very versatile. I hope all of these things are useful for you, the information that I've given you, and that you have a wonderful week coming up to Pesach and in a couple of weeks' time, and that you're not too stressed about it. This is Adrian Bugatti, and you were listening to the Essen Fressen Show.